Welcome to the Heart Rate Variability Podcast. Each week we talk about heart rate variability and how it can be used to improve your overall health and wellness. Please consider the information in this podcast for your informational use and not medical advice. Please see your medical provider to apply any of the strategies outlined in this episode. Heart Rate Variability Podcast is a production of Optimal LLC and Optimal HRV. Check us out at optimalhrv.com. Please enjoy the show. Welcome, friends, to the Heart Rate Variability Podcast. I am Matt Bennett. I'm here with a real special guest today. I met Dr. Lauren Kennedy Metz at AAPB last year. And I don't know, like, you go to conferences sometimes and you meet a lot of new people, but there's occasionally somebody you meet that you just really want to become your best friend. And that is the best way I can describe my interactions with Lauren. And I was just so happy that she's joining the podcast today, because I think after this interview, you will want to be her best friend too. If you're an HRV nerd and you're passionate about heart rate variability, she is your person. So Lauren, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you on today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Awesome. Well, I know a little bit about your background, but I would also like to learn more. How about just to start us out, just kind of a quick introduction. What are you doing? Who are you? Get just a little background for our readers.
Sure. So I can give you my background, maybe like academically, that Perfect. Led me to where I am. Okay. So let's see. Well, I grew up in the Boston area. And I ended up going to school in Southwest Virginia for college. It's like a small liberal arts college, which was a little random, but it ended up being like the best choice I could have made. I studied psychology and also creative writing and neuroscience, which also probably sound kind of random, but I just really liked it. I wanted to take advantage of the liberal arts setting. So yeah, that was fun. I did some research, different types of research as an undergrad. So ultimately, I went straight to grad school. I stayed in Virginia. I went to Virginia Tech, and I completed my PhD in translational biology, medicine, and health. So it was kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure.
Yeah.
And the PI that I ended up working with, was her background, her name is Dr. Sarah Parker. Her background is in human factors in healthcare. So that was really my first exposure to human factors, which is an incredible field. It was also my first exposure to heart rate variability while working in that lab, because she joined as a faculty member with a grant that I kind of plugged into. And the one area that was the most interesting to me of that grant was the psychophysiology part of it. So that's how I ended up getting interested in heart rate variability in the first place. And based on her background, I was applying that to healthcare as a graduate student. So after 4 years, I finished and I moved on to my postdoc at the VA, the Veterans Affairs in Boston. I worked with Dr. Marco Zanotti, who's the chief of cardiothoracic surgery there. And after about a year, I moved into kind of a junior faculty role at Harvard Medical School. So I was doing mostly the same stuff, but it was just kind of a title change. That work involved very similar stuff to what I was doing in my dissertation, but bringing it into the operating room. So I was in the cardiac OR recording cases, like audio video recording, and collecting heart rate variability from the surgeons and like the anesthesiologists and the people doing the surgeries. It was so cool. It was a really incredible project that I had the opportunity to lead. It was multidisciplinary, NIH funded, multi-institute. Like, it was wild. It was really, really fun. I learned a lot and I loved being in the OR. And then I ended up back where I started, basically. I learned that I wanted to be in a liberal arts setting. That's kind of where I felt the most comfortable. So when the position that I have now opened up at my alma mater, I applied really quickly. And so yeah, I'm back at my alma mater and I'm in the psychology department teaching psychology and neuroscience.
That's awesome. And meeting some of your students too at the conference. The liberal arts spirit must be alive at Roanoke, because I just like the creativity around how they were thinking Some of their the research that they were doing just was really spectacular. I just there's something about that environment that is really, it seems to be maximized in you, your students. So something's going right there at Roanoke College.
Yes,
So
it's a
I would love to hear a little bit more because you told me because I had like 1,000 questions on it, but I think our listeners will be fascinated too. The emergent, the ER, or the operation, the operating surgery. Let's talk a little bit about that because this is where I think heart rate variability can really look under the hood of what's going on in these
yeah.
intense situations. So I would love, I didn't want to jump in and interrupt the introduction, but I would love to just share a little bit more about that, some of your findings, just kind of what the amazing thing that you did there. I got to share that with our listeners.
Yeah, it was really fun. It's really messy. I mean, the OR is a messy environment in a lot of ways. I don't know, physically and also just, yeah, physiologically, if you think about all of the things that are going on, and we talked about cognitive workload a lot, and we use that term more often than stress, I think, in the work that we were doing in the ORs, because there was more than just like physiological stress. There was the demands from the task, the demands from the team, the demands from the patient, all of these things that were factoring in. So that was kind of the starting point, I guess, of that project, was just like trying to figure out like, can we measure this? It's really messy, but it's really important because we're kind of operating under this definition of like, there is a threshold somewhere. So we can only handle so much stress. And eventually we're all susceptible to this sort of cliff of too much stress, being overloaded, and then experiencing a performance decrement. And if it's me teaching in front of a classroom and I have this sensation, then like whatever, my students are like, wow, she lost her train of thought, or it doesn't really matter. It's just like a momentary thing. If it's a surgeon operating on someone's heart and their hands are in this guy's chest, then it's a lot more serious. So the implications of high risk, high consequence. And yeah, like the implications of that sort of cliff of reaching that point are much more serious. So, and no one had really collected data as far as we had known from the operating room. Usually it was like simulations or even high fidelity simulations. That's kind of the stuff that I was operating in during my grad school studies. So it was a new world, just a naturalistic environment, right? Like in the wild. And that's one reason that I say it was really messy, because we couldn't really, there was so much we couldn't control for. But we were just, it really was kind of hypothesis generating, kind of exploratory. We were collecting data from the attending surgeon, attending anesthesiologist, primary perfusionist, and scrub nurse. And yeah, we had this like really decomposed list that our collaborators at UMass Amherst computer scientists created of what a typical cardiac surgery should look like. So we had like very discrete things like behavioral indicators to look for and to annotate. And then I would go back and sort of map those onto what was happening physiologically with the providers. So it was just a really rich data set. Lots of different types of data that we're working with. And kind of the culmination of that project was actually just published in the Journal of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgery. So we're really excited that that's out there.
Nice. And this is the second podcast within a few weeks where we're talking about using, I believe this is what I'm hearing, HRV in real time in the field. The last episode, which hasn't published yet when we're recording this one, but will soon, was looking at police. It was still a simulated, but it was, simulations they go through as part of their training. And anyway, and so, there just seems to me, as somebody who's so focused on like getting artifacts out of readings and trying to manage technology in a way where we get with, how are you able, knowing that HRV can be a very sensitive metric, how are you able to really isolate, different things, deal with artifacts, those sort of aspects of, I would imagine collecting HRV data in an OR would like put forth to you to overcome.
Yeah. I mean, and you sound kind of like a reviewer that might have gone back to us in our manuscripts, because that's a good
I don't
question.
Know if that's good association, or you got published, so I assume it's not, you know, too bad, but yeah.
No, it is a good question. Like, and I consider myself to be like very methods heavy, methods oriented. And so it was something I spent a lot of time thinking about. And especially, like I was saying, I came from a more controlled environment. And so it was kind of like opening up a can of worms. And the fortunate thing was that I had spent a lot of time figuring out, kind of comparing different equipment and software and testing them out and going through this really in-depth process. So then when I got to this and joined this group in Boston, one grant was ending and they were proposing a renewal that was kind of an extension of that first one. And so I was there at a really good time because I had a lot of background in sort of, I think expertise in that area of like, how do we optimize the data that we're collecting? And so we don't have to throw half of it out, because the project that had wrapped up when I was getting there, they were using the Polar H10 sensors, which is fine. I'm not like talking trash, they're a great device. but there's a lot of data loss in an environment that has a lot of movement. There is a lot of movement artifacts, but there's also potential for data loss with a Bluetooth disconnect. So, but this is a really complicated environment to sort of sort out all of those logistics. So I just kind of, I like that challenge. I put my head down and I just figured out like, what's the best possible way we can do this? And we were in the process of submitting this grant to the NIH. So we shot for the moon in terms of the grant proposal and budget justification. And it works out.
Well, and I'm so excited that we're, you know, with the police folks, they basically had a human observer writing down like everything the officer was doing. So if they, you know, the officer, as you and I both know, most of you stand up, your HRV changes, right? You move, your HRV changes here and there. So they were doing that. And I get really excited about this type of work, because if we find ways to get meaningful HRV data in real life situations, I mean, just think about what that opens up in every realm. For me as a therapist, for a professional athlete, for police force, for teachers, for students, like all this stuff now really becomes, I don't know, it just like quadruples the amount of research that we can be doing if we figure out what I think is a very, very challenging problem to overcome. But the fact that like people are doing it, like yourself, just gives me so much hope that we'll get there eventually.
It was also complicated by the fact that like, I mean, and I'm not going to get in the weeds of like the analytical problems, but like there's a lot of like nested sort of relationships. So we're talking about a single operating room with like three attending surgeons, five anesthesiologists, a handful of perfusionists, a handful of nurses. And so at any given time, there's only a composition includes one of those, one of the surgeons, one of the anesthesiologists, whatever, you know? So like surgeon A could be working with a totally different team, like five different cases in a row. So there's like, but within a certain case, if we're sort of decomposing this into phases, it's the same surgeon during the opening as it is during anastomosis, as it is during every phase within a single surgery. So there's all these within sort of interperson variability, but then the team composition is nested. So it was just really, really complicated from an analytical standpoint too, which is another reason that I'm really excited that this paper was accepted, because it was a lot of complicated challenges to have to overcome.
Yes, spectacular. So here's probably a non-reviewer type question for you. Do you, after this, feel better or worse if you had to go in for surgery? I'm assuming that's not in the paper, so I'll ask that. Would you feel better now, or would you be a little bit more scared to go into surgery?
Yeah, that's funny to think about. I mean, I don't even know how to answer that. I want to say, like, from a human perspective, so much better, because not even research, like setting the research aside, I had like such a cool opportunity to just watch open heart surgery. My whole job for like 3.5 years, I spent hundreds of hours observing people, like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to get into details, but it was so cool. And then, like, they're so good at what they do. I mean, they spend decades training. They're literally experts in every aspect of what they're doing. And so the idea that, like, something stressful could come into the picture, it never resulted in anything. I mean, we had probably 70 something cases from start to finish recorded after these two grants were completed. And the morbidity mortality rates were like zero. I mean, they're the best at what they do. So in that sense, it was like inspiring, and I would feel great about going under the knife for cardiac surgery.
Is there another side? there seems to be something else. There seems to be an and there, you know, that I feel comfortable talking about it.
It's just funny because, like, this was never part of the conversation for previous generations of surgeons, from my understanding. I don't have clinical training, but, like, how to cope with pressure and how to manage your stress was never really part of those trainings. So people were figuring it out on the fly. And this is kind of what drew me towards this area in the first place. The idea that you're doing this crazy thing in cardiac surgery, you're literally delivering this cardioplegia, this chemical that is stopping the patient's heart. You're killing a patient on purpose and then supporting their life through an extracorporeal system, like closed circuit, extra body system. Like, it's mind blowing. And to think that, like, that's what you're training for decades, but no one ever gives you explicit training on, like, how to manage your emotions if you're in the heat of it, or, like, how to make decisions when you're overwhelmed. Like, you're just figuring that stuff out on your own. That's crazy to me. And that they're still so good at it, even though they never received formal training. So yeah, I think it's interesting because, like, it's an opportunity, right? People are starting to warm up to the idea of, like, oh, I do experience stress sometimes, and I could see that it could impact my performance. And if that is, like, people are open-minded that that's even a remote possibility, then we can start to actually consider interventions and, like, how do we mitigate that? Or, yeah, so the whole thing is very exciting to me.
Awesome. So when one of the things that I just, and this is not, I always let my guests speculate and did not attach something to research, and more of an opinion I'd love to get from you as an expert. But one of the things is I do work with organizations around heart rate variability as, you know, the tracker of, you know, everything heart rate variability does. And for most jobs, you kind of mentioned this, that if you show up and your heart rate variability is 20, 30, 40% lower than your average, you know, probably nobody gets hurt. Maybe your students don't get quite the best of you, but I'm assuming somebody like you would give it all to your students and crash afterwards. Anyway, so, I mean, we can manage that. You know, I think about these CERN occupations, though, like the person flying my plane, the person doing surgery on me, the police officer going out for a shift, that there's so much, you know, at stake. What if a surgeon wakes up 40% below? What if the pilot wakes up 40% below? What if the police officer wakes up 40% below? You know, and I can say, well, the surgeon probably has to go in and do surgery. However, I don't want them doing surgery on me that day. Like it's like these industries would probably grind to a halt if we took this seriously. But at the same time, I don't want you flying my plane if your nervous system is crashing right now and you're not managing your stress well. So I kind of wonder, spending so much time with individuals and probably getting to know their HRV fairly well too, like, what are your, and I won't make it about surgeons in general, but just these high risk professions, what do you think ethically, if we got data that Matt's not doing great today, and Matt's scheduled to fly a plane across the country, where do you sit with this? This has been a constant ethical dilemma that I'm not really sure what to do with, because I also do want my plane to get me where I want to go at the same time. So It's a tricky question, but I just love to get kind of your thoughts on, we can now identify this person's not in a good state right now. What do we do with that in these high risk situations?
Well, I think like the first thing is that is like kind of mandatory in that situation is a self-awareness. So it's up to that person, right? Like, you might not be able to tell just from kind of observing from the outside that anyone is going through anything physiologically that is concerning. Right. So there's like a self-awareness piece that has to come first, and then a decision that is like ethical, I guess, and responsible that has to come afterwards. But if like folks aren't actually recognizing that they're in a potentially dangerous state, then they're never going to be able to resolve it or do anything about it. So I think that's kind of the first thing. And then in terms of surgeons, I mean, I don't know about pilots or many other populations, but I mean, RMSSD is like my favorite measure. Their RMSSD values were like in the single digits, real low, like constantly. But that's not really their baseline, but like when they're in the OR, that is normal. Right. So like, it's mind blowing a little bit actually to think about that, but,
Do you think that sympathetic kind of dominance kicking in a little bit because of the stress, or do you think they're just, I mean, healthcare isn't well known for, you know, healthy workforce to begin with.
Oh yeah. Well, so we couldn't actually collect a lot of data about their health, like if they're on beta blockers or like things like that, because they're employees as well. Yeah. But, so the IRB did not let us collect stuff like that, but it's just a stressful environment. It doesn't matter like how healthy you are. Like it's hard to be in a cardiac operating room and to be managing so many different things at once. I mean, there's so many different machines, different types of equipment. The patient could present with some sort of anatomical thing you weren't expecting, even if you've looked at all of their scans and everything. Like, there's just so many things that could go wrong, and you're constantly like on your toes and trying to anticipate stuff. But also working with other humans is hard. Like, it's literally the hardest of every single task you could have to do, but like all in one. So anyway, I don't know if like there's like really a cutoff where it's like, this isn't safe to operate, because they're probably below that cutoff all the time.
That is scary and fascinating, because they're good at, I mean, like you said, they seem to have bat 100%.
Yeah.
With morbidity mortality rates being what they were, like, yeah. And yet, like, and that's where I wonder, because I would think, I mean, if I thought about the ideal state of a surgeon, which I have no expertise in this arena as well, so I'm just, I've watched ER growing up is basically my expertise on this. But it seemed like you would want someone very regulated, very RMSSD up, you know, like you'd want somebody like zen out in the flow. And I don't know if those single digit scores would be indicating that, but it sounds like the outcomes is showing us that, yeah, you can show up in the single digit RMSSD and be a great surgeon, which is really reassuring in many ways.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that's, I guess I should maybe correct or re-clarify too, it wasn't like necessarily throughout the entire surgery, but part of what the work that we were doing was, since we could separate the surgery into distinct phases that were like universal across all of the types of surgeries we recorded, we could say like, well, at first we separated them into 14 phases. In this paper, we sort of reestablished the boundaries. So there's like 8 phases. Mm-hmm. But then you could compare pretty directly. Like, what is the surgeon's physiological state looking like during intubation, which is like 100% an anesthesia task?
Yeah.
And then what are those both like when the roles are reversed? Like when the surgeon is like elbow deep doing his repair, and then the anesthesiologist is kind of on autopilot mode, like vigilant, but not doing the primary task. So Yeah, we could really kind of drill down into like how does this evolve over the course of a surgery within a single person? And then the other side of it is like if we look at a certain moment in time, how do these roles compare to each other?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So I wonder if there's any more. I don't know if we can talk much about the data since it hasn't been published, but just maybe like 30,000 foot epiphanies that as you spent, because I just knowing you a little bit and having a few conversations with you, as you were observing, I would imagine your head started spinning and thinking, what am I seeing? And I'm sure again, just with my, maybe you're not, but I'm sure that spinning didn't stop after you walked out and you were chewing on this for years. Were there like, did you learn anything about like human beings? And I, you know, I just like 30,000 foot, like maybe that are too kind of grandiose for a research-based peer-reviewed journal, but just kind of like what kind of epiphanies rose out of this really incredible study and time that you spent with somebody's kind of dead on the table for a second, and then you know, like all this powerful stuff going on, and you're witnessing this with a very inquisitive, analytical and inquisitive and creative brain of yours.
Yeah, there were so many different directions to go in. Like, I don't think you could ever really exhaust this data set. I mean, I didn't even talk about some of the data we have too. Like, we had a sound level meter that was measuring the decibel, like just the volume in the OR, and there we presented a few things looking into that data and how the volume, like just ambient volume in the OR, was like kind of comparing over the course of the surgery to the heart rate variability of the different providers. So that's like a rabbit hole you could go down. But also it's funny because like the physical setup when I was doing this project, like I was sitting outside of the OR and streaming the what was happening inside the OR. Because it was COVID time, so I couldn't be like in the operating room. So I was sitting outside and had headphones because we had cameras and microphones and all this stuff. And I was watching it from like the next room over. And people would come out into the little hallway that I was sitting in and be like, "Did you see that? Like, that was so stressful for me. Please look at the data, my data at that point." And like constantly, like everyone knew me. I've been doing this for a few years too. And so like people would just be like, "Oh my gosh, that trainee was so annoying. Can we look into like what my heart rate does when I'm training people versus not?" Because it was a teaching hospital. So they're just like people just came to me with a bunch of questions and ideas, and I mostly just ran with
That is
them.
awesome. I would
I
love
was
it. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry.
oh well, I was gonna say like my interest from like that kind of hooked me in this area very early on in grad school was in biofeedback. So that's always been like kind of my like lofty, maybe it's not very feasible at this point in time, but like one day once we understand these processes and how they're occurring well enough, maybe we could introduce something like biofeedback and ideally in real time, like that would be so cool. And so we actually did kind of like a proof of concept using the data from the cases that we've recorded. And so some of the folks that we worked with, we published this like last year, I think. There's kind of a proof of concept of like, could we get like a real-time team-wide indicator and present that information back to the team? And so that would be my like ultimate kind of application of all of this.
That is so awesome. I wonder, I would love to hear what you think about the sound, because one of the things that I've been, and this comes from reading something or listening to Stephen Porges somewhere along the line, and I've just been obsessed with it ever since, is that kind of low grade ambient noise can be a trigger the sympathetic. And then I'm, you know, having been in mental health, we have like white noise machines, which seems like really ambient noise. So I'm like, oh God, was I triggering somebody with the white noise machine? With that, you know, I'd love to hear what you were seeing with that, because it's something that I, you know, with therapists, I get now, I hesitate to almost mention it because I know a lot of them use, especially working in offices, they use the noise machines, and nobody really has, you know, much control if they're by a highway and stuff's going by all the time. So I'd love to hear kind of what were some of your insights about the noise and the stress levels.
Yeah, I think we were expecting that just like as noise levels elevated, so too would physiological arousal.
Yeah.
And that's not what we saw for the most part. It's kind of the opposite, but I think it also kind of makes sense if you think about like how a surgery progresses. So there's one phase that's like just the most insanely out of this world demanding is the surgical repair. Mm-hmm. And it has to be very quiet in the room during that, because so if you're thinking about like a graft, you've probably heard of like the bypass graft. That's kind of bread and butter cardiac surgery. They're taking a vein out of someone's leg and literally stitching it onto the surface of their heart. Like, you can't even like see the stitches with the naked eye. It's so hard. It's so like meticulous, and they're wearing these crazy magnifying glasses on their heads. And it's just like, there's so many things going on in that moment that they can't, you could like hear a pin drop in the room, and they would probably get pissed if they did. So, so it's really quiet during that period, but it's also the most stressful time of the surgeries. Yeah. It's very tense at the same, versus like, there's two primary team-wide phases. That's like putting the patient on the bypass machine and then weaning them off of the bypass machine. There's like, you have to coordinate those activities really closely within the four team members. And so there's communication happening, right? You have to announce like, we're coming off pump and the anesthesiologist is watching this and the perfusionists are watching this, and they have to be communicating it. So there's kind of a lot of noise. But it's not necessarily associated with a lot of arousal. So it was a little counterintuitive, but one of the other things we were looking at was like, just like spikes, because like sometimes if someone drops an instrument, like a piece of metal onto a metal tray, and it's very loud, then we're getting over 85 decibels really easily, even if it's just for a moment in time. And so I think that's a kind of future direction that would be interesting to look at in this data set too, be like isolating those moments where there's just a sudden momentary spike in noise, and then like just trying to see what's happening behaviorally, also physiologically, socially, all of those things. So we don't have a lot of definitive kind of data about the noise stuff at this point, but I think that's the next step probably.
Awesome. So I also wonder, because you know, there's certain arenas where acknowledging any sort of weakness, including that you're stressed out, is just culturally not accepted. And for whatever stupid reason, healthcare has one of those. I mean, I find physicians I work with just, like you've got a doctorate degree in medicine. Like, can you take, but even their training, when they talk about their training and how like it is almost trying to destroy, if I were trying to destroy somebody as a human being, it would kind of be, and I think we're getting a little bit better on this, but it would be like a medical residency. Like we're working 24, 48 hours. I'm like, what science would this support any of this? For the physician or the resident and the people they're treating, because it's like a zombie giving medical care after 48 hours of no real sleep. So I wonder, like, as you, it sounded like you got real interest from some of the team that was in there. Do you feel like this might be an entry? Because I've known a few surgeons, and they're not really touchy-feely, I guess would be a nice way to say it. Not going to tell you they're stressed out. You know, all that sort of mentality that for some reason gets instilled in healthcare workers. So I wonder if you saw any doors opening to these conversations from as you had data, because I would assume they'd be very interested as they're having somebody's heart maybe actually in their hands and you're measuring their heartbeat. What were there doors that might've opened there for talking about the wellness of the team themselves?
Yeah. So it's funny that you mentioned that, Is the connection still good?
Yeah, I think we're good.
Okay, just good. So when I started out doing this for my dissertation, one of the projects that I ran was interviewing folks in the hospital. It wasn't necessarily surgeons, but I just got a smattering of, but most of them ended up being surgeons. And I was kind of trying to run by, like, if we were to imagine a biofeedback intervention that could help you to manage your stress, which was really my interest, like, what should it look like? What should the modality of the delivery be? Or like all of these sorts of things. But all of those questions are really predicated on the acknowledgement of stress. And so those conversations were like non-starters at first, because surgeons would tell me, I've never been stressed. And they're like so serious. They'd be like,
I know, they believe it. They believe it, right?
Like, never? Like, how?
Do you know anything about the human? And I mean, you hold people's hearts in your hands. How?
It's like a sign of weakness. And it's like, it's equated to incompetence to admit stress or any sort of like, whatever, imperfection. And so that then also a lot of those folks that were sharing those things with me said along the lines of what you were mentioning of like residency, you know, they would be doing some task, maybe it's simulated, hopefully it wasn't a patient, and their attending would be yelling at them or like degrading them or something like that. And like, they had to get thick skin. They had to just like deal with it. And so they would say, yeah, I'm not stressed because I was trained under constant stress. But they also admit as a sidebar that like, that's not acceptable anymore. So a lot of the attendings nowadays who have been in practice for like decades, they would say, if I were to treat my residents the way that I was treated, I'd be fired. So that's a good sign.
And I'm so glad you're hearing that, because I heard for a while, well, I had to go through it. This is how you become a healer, is by destroying yourself.
Right.
Psychologically, we got to break you in order for you to be able to heal people.
Yeah. Well,
but I'm glad maybe that is retiring.
Yeah. And so I would say also with this group where we did this really cool project, one of the key things that really led to its success is that it was led by the chief of cardiothoracic surgery, Dr. Marco Zanotti. And so he was the one saying, we are fallible. We are not inhuman, right? Like, we are all susceptible to these momentary weaknesses and things like that. And so he really, like, he modeled that. And he's the one that sort of fostered this acceptance. Because I couldn't do it. Like, a psychologist being like, I think you're stressed. Like, they'd be like, get out. So it had to come from, like, one of their own. And it was like, that's rare. It's really rare for someone to admit that, and someone in a leadership position to admit that and then like rally the troops. And so this project, it took years for folks to get on board and for them to even submit it to an IRB, because no one really trusted the premise of it at first. Yeah. And so like literally, I think it was like 5 years of Dr. Zanotti and another nurse kind of like eating away, like trying to like wedge their way in. And then by the time I got there, it was like already established. So I just stepped in and everyone, it was fine. I didn't really have to do that hard legwork, but it's not likely that that would really happen somewhere else without that culture.
Right. Exactly. So I wonder, like, coming out of this, the research, I wonder kind of what other questions are driving you now. Now, you know, your professor, your students are doing some amazing research, you know, that I just started just nerding out totally about at the conference. Just kind of like, you had this amazing, I mean, I really hope your study changes healthcare. Like, it opens, it just gives data where it just fills this void, I think, of what's out there in such an amazing way. So you've been a part of this, I hope, world-changing study. Now you're settling in, you're kind of back to your liberal arts home, getting comfortable. What thoughts are on your mind? What's your work look like now? What gets you excited?
Yeah, it is. It's a little different now because the setting is so different. And I'm not like, so before my office was in the hospital, right? It was really easy to just kind of spitball ideas and get people on board once they were interested in the project. So it's different now in that sense. So I've kind of shifted, instead of thinking like exclusively about surgeons, they're a great population to study.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking more along the lines of like any human that experiences stress, which is every human.
Except for surgeons.
Never.
You almost studied a subpopulation of you by their own words, right? They're
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess like the idea that I'm operating under is I'm thinking about like this mixed methods approach of like collect kind of similarly to how this project was working in Boston. But the idea would be like collecting physiological data while people are just doing their job. So not intervening at all, just observing, making some ethnographic notes, maybe whatever. And then the qualitative part would be bringing that data to those folks and asking, oh, like during this period of time, it looks like your arousal is increasing. Were you stressed? Were you excited? Like what was happening? So getting that sort of explanatory side and using the quantitative and the qualitative then together to derive some sort of very tailored specific intervention for that group specifically. So it's like, if you were to take that whole thing that I said and apply it to surgeons, the outcome would look really different than if you were to take that whole pipeline and apply it to a student or a police officer or whatever. So I'm thinking really about like, what are populations that experience stress that I can observe that we can like work with to develop some sort of intervention for stress management? And yeah, right now I'm starting this work actually with bartenders. That's recent.
So you're like, you know, you're in hospitals, now you're in bars.
Yeah, so craft brewery bartenders. That one's like underway. It's actually been really exciting. I started analyzing some of the data yesterday and it's kind of cool. And then I'm going to try. So, I mean, I did my PhD in this area. And so I still, my PhD advisor is still here. She's still doing her work, really amazing work. And so I'm probably going to try to actually partner with her soon and get back into healthcare. She runs like an incredible simulation center that's operated by like the hospital in this region. So I'm probably going to try to get back into healthcare through sims early days and then maybe like expand it.
Awesome.
But yeah, otherwise, but if a student comes to me with a really cool idea that has something to do with like psychophysiology and heart rate variability, then we just go with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's so cool to have that. And what's your experience? I mean, I've been trying to get students and I've been successful lately, and it just kind of like, you know, because there's some people with more white hair than I have walking around the HR world, but I realize I'm not the youngest person in it. If I'm the youngest person in the room, you better go to the hallway and get some younger people at this point. But what do you see about this with a generation that grew up, you know, with smartphones, not just with, you know, a mobile phone or a cell, but you know, that, you know, they may have always had this amazing computer on there. They've grown up with technology. What do you see kind of their reaction, their excitement around heart rate variability, besides having a great advocate for it, like you as a teacher, that's got to really help. But what do you see their interest being?
Well, the other thing that they have going for them is that they grew up with like biofeedback, like on their wrists, right? Everyone has a smartwatch. So they're all aware of their stress state or their heart rate at any point in time. So that actually makes it easier for me, right? It's a selling point. It's a little more accessible for students to be interested because they're familiar with it, whether they know it or not. I think that it's a relatable concept to get on board with. And it's also just like intuitive. I mean, an EKG waveform is so beautiful. And it's just like a nice thing to look at, an easy thing to read, to understand, to analyze. And so I think students like that it's like kind of an, it seems like a lofty parameter, but it's not EEG. Like, you don't need like really crazy software.
Right.
And it's more, a little more relatable, and they can tie it into the stuff that they're interested in. So the three projects that I had going on at the same time last semester were completely different, but they were all very tied to their, those students' individual interests.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing. It's like flexible, it's relatable, and it's easy to get excited about it, I think.
Yeah, but I like that, because our stress response and everything else that HRV is an indicator of, like, I like to, they're, you know, drink kombucha, not alcohol, but like a kombucha drinking game around, you know, Google HRV and anything. And, you know, it's kind of harder than not to find something that there hasn't been a study on. And that's what I love about, like, what the sense I got from talking to some of your students is, and you gave words to it, they have an interest in this, and then they can work with you to bring HRV into whether it's video games or other exciting things that might be going on, that they're studying things they're interested in. And really, now that we've, you know, the generations that before me really helped define this, I have to tell some people new to HRV, I don't need to prove this. You don't need to find me a grant to prove heart rate variability is a valid measure. Like, we've done, this work is there. Go do your own meta study review. But now it's like they're filling these gaps in an incredibly innovative way. And it just, man, it just brings joy to my heart that there is enough space to run. And then they've got teachers like you. You know, I talked to the, you know, Professor Moss, Steph, other Gravertz, like there's just these great professors that get the next generation excited. And that's where I love to see what's going to be coming next out of this energy that you are all fostering in your students.
Yeah. And so one of my students that was at that conference graduated, and she's starting her master's program now in experimental psychology. So I don't know if she'll be using heart rate variability, but there's a chance. There's a pretty good chance.
We keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah.
So I always like to ask my guests, and I'm going to say on our first episode, because I really hope to have you back. I gotta nerd out with you about the bartender study once you're ready to talk about that data. And I'm sure there's a million rabbit holes that we can dive into. But as somebody who, I just love how you think about heart rate variability, you know, where do you see us going with this? Where do you see us 5-10 years out, technology developing? You may have answered that in some way, shape, or form already, but where do you see, if you can fast forward 10 years with all AI progression, like, I think we're hitting a new, especially around data, like, whole different reality, which is, I think, from our perspective, incredibly exciting. Maybe from the world ending perspective, who knows? But, you know, from our, it's going to benefit us on the way out if it takes it that way. But just kind of like, what are you excited about? Where do you see us going, you know, in the future?
Well, I'm thinking about like the stuff that I was the most heavily involved with, all this OR stuff. And I mentioned biofeedback would be great.
Yeah.
But I also think this is an area that group is exploring right now too. But the idea of like projecting cognitive or physiological states based on previous and current data. So really using real-time stuff to anticipate, right? Because it's one thing to be aware of your current state and to react to it. But if you know, for example, that you're approaching that threshold, what can you do ahead of time to not to not get there? And so if we can like use whatever we're learning now and whatever we've learned in the past to sort of reliably anticipate what could be coming down the road in 10 or 15 seconds, even if it's like not for you. I mean, so one of the things that, this is kind of a sidebar, but one of the things that drew me into this area of biofeedback was watching these simulations where emergency medicine residents were shown like a stoplight indicator, traffic light indicator of their stress. And they were like, I know I'm at 85% and I'm in the red zone, but what am I supposed to do about it? So they actually didn't like having that information presented to themselves. And I think that that's probably true of a lot of people operating in that really high risk, high consequence setting. So something that we talked about at the VA and Harvard was maybe it's an indicator that represents the surgeon's stress level that the surgeon doesn't have to see. It could be equally informative for the rest of the room to know when their levels, his or her levels, are getting really dangerously high, because that's like a clear indicator, like, don't interrupt, don't open and close the doors, don't take a phone call. Like, and so especially if you can project it out, then again, that might be useful, maybe not for the individual whose stress it represents, but for the people around them to know about.
Yeah. Well, if you like, and you know, I share your passion for biofeedback, like if there is that moment to take a few breaths, like if there is a way to catch that, you know, that's where, like, you know, knowing that there are RMSSDs in the single digits, you know, just as a alert to say, hey, if it's possible, can we all, because I know in some parts of the surgery, it's impossible to do that probably, but is it now or before we start this next piece of the, could we just take the, some, maybe some, well, if they're doing their RF breathing, right? They're not breathing together. Like, you know, just to take a few, a minute, if that's even possible, to take 4-6 breaths, low, slow breaths to help regulate. I think that that's, would be a fascinating. I've been nerding out, as the listeners know, about introspection, and I almost hear what you're saying. It's like predictive introspection. Like, not only am I aware of my state, but I'm aware of my near future state.
Yeah.
And how do I interrupt that? And can heart rate variability, you know, buzz something or send something that would allow them to intervene before they hit that.
There's a group in Switzerland that's doing really cool work. It's not necessarily related to like breathing or coping or stress in any way, but it's, they've implemented the STOP protocol, and it stands for something, I don't remember what it stands for, but it's like led by the surgeon, and it's the surgeon's opportunity to say stop, we're going to assess, get on the same page, and anyone can request to stop at any time.
There's
psychological safety built into this fabric. And, but if you could do that sort of stop protocol, but then like fold in some sort of like, let's also just take a deep breath.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And give them that skill set, and then maybe convince them to practice some biofeedback outside.
Yeah.
So they built that strength, even though they've never gotten stressed out in their life.
Right.
Just, you know, just to do a little work, be a good team member, because we'll want the nurses to do it and the techs and everybody else. So just be a good teammate. Yeah, we know you never get stressed. But,
I know, it's so unbelievable.
It is. And they know this about themselves too. That's the thing. They will kind of own it in a proud way, which is like, I'm like, you are silly. You are silly. Well, my friend, this has been a remarkable study. Like I said, I feel like there's multiple rabbit holes we could explore. And I hope you come back and bring some of your students along maybe throughout the year. They're doing good work. But I saw them pop up, and I wonder if our YouTube watchers, could you show your tattoos to?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So,
okay. So this is my husband's EKG, and mine is on his forearm. Yeah.
That will bring joy to all the HRV nerds that listen to this podcast. With that, and I hope my wife doesn't listen to this episode, because I don't have hers on mine. So
That is spectacular.
That is spectacular. So we'll put some information about Lauren in the show notes. But my friend, thank you so much, and the door is always open for you or your students to come back and share the amazing work you're doing. I just appreciate you, your energy, and can't wait to read the paper.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to do this. This is really fun.
Absolutely.
And I'll take you up on the follow-up with students. I've already told some of my students, you got to prepare for this because we're
yeah,
going
good,
on this
good, good. Yeah, it
podcast.
should be part of, you know, getting that A. You look, maybe I can be extra credit. Maybe I can be extra credit. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much. And for our listeners, as always, you can find show notes, information about Lauren and more at optimalhrv.com. Lauren, thank you so much. And as always, I'll see everybody next week.
Thank you.